opening the book bag today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we're going to dig into the book bag and review some books. That's the program today on Scribble. You know, we get involved in interesting conversations, and some people have said, yeah, well, how about the book reviews?
I know. People do miss the book reviews, and I know people go out and buy some of the books that we recommend.
Oh, well, good. Well, today, book reviews. We're not talking to anybody but each other, and boy, is that a chore. Here we are in the middle of just the most frigid weather I can imagine. And that's a good time to sit inside and read a book.
We've lived in our house for 58 years, and never before have I been iced in for 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, literally iced in. Our driveway is still a skating pond.
You know, it is amazing. The east side of our street, we live halfway up a hill. It's ice 5 inches thick in some places. And then you go down to the avenue, and suddenly there's another glacier that spreads down in front of about 3 different houses. You think, holy mackerel, I've never seen this in all the years I've lived here. It's, I think they were working on the hillside at Hauberg and using heavy machinery,
right.
And the grass and stuff is gone. First came an avalanche of mud, and now water, 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 and ice. Wow.
Fortunately, we have books and minds.
Yes, we do.
So I have done a lot of very eclectic reading.
Well, mine was difficult, but some pleasure along the way. But, yeah, I get into a tough book. But let's talk.
I want to start with a single word.
Okay.
About 20 years ago, the Irish poet Seamus Heaney, really a great poet. I'm not sure he won the Nobel Prize or not, but he should have, did a new translation of Beowulf. And he began, the original Beowulf begins with the word what, H-W-A-E-T, what. He began it with the word so. And ever since then, in the last 20 years, you can't hear an interview on television or in person or anywhere if you ask a person a question, you know, when did you decide to take the trip, that the first word isn't so.
Really?
So, you remember, I mean, are you from, do you hear that? So.
I don't think I've listened to that much. As a creature.
What's the power of that word so?
Well,
that was a brilliant opening to Beowulf.
It means something is coming. So, okay, that I have not only is something coming, but I've considered this, and this is what you
that
ought
something
to hear.
Has happened in the past too, though, right? So,
yeah.
So is a continuation.
Uh huh.
But it is. I've started listening for it, and particularly being snowed in, and you hear it on the national news. You hear it on local news. So.
Well, that's a very useful word.
Well, it's an incredible word.
Yeah. But, you know, the sounds that we use for words are in themselves fascinating. And there are times when I suddenly take a word and repeat it and repeat it, and the sound of it, you know, sometimes sounds rather strange.
Yeah.
How did we wind up with that particular sound for this particular thought? It's fascinating. And the whole business of speech, when I was teaching speech, I was telling one of the things I used for the kids, I said, isn't it fascinating that an idea lights in your mind and the sounds that come out of your mouth can light that fire in another mind? That's magic. That's absolute magic. And you ought to pay attention to how you exercise this magic and use it precisely. But that image has stayed with me all my life.
Emerson has an answer for that. The quotes of his I really like is, "All language is fossil poetry." And then he explains that a few paragraphs later by saying, "Every word was once a poem."
I suppose that's as true as anything.
And the example he uses, inspire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Today, to us, that's an abstract word, to get inspired. What does that mean? And I tried this out on my students all the time. Why is it called inspire? You know, it's a strange phrase. We know what it means, right? The light bulb goes on and so forth. But inspiration is the opposite of expiration, right?
Yeah.
Spiration is breath. In is coming in. And whoever first noticed the way in which when that light bulb goes on or an idea suddenly hits, you almost involuntarily breathe. Nobody at that moment of inspiration ever breathes out.
That's very true. I know.
So inspiration was once a poem. Somebody saw the relationship between the act of breathing in and the light bulb going on in your mind.
Yeah, knowing Latin, I don't know Latin, but I know in and spiro, yeah, that's true, breathe in.
But it was once a concrete word. It had visual context.
Yeah.
And now it's just a fossil.
I notice there are efforts being made to revive extinct languages all over the place. They've got a real project going on in Hawaii. They're reviving Hawaiian. And it's taken off. They did that in Ireland. They've had projects like that in Wales. And there's an Indian tribe where the language was all but lost completely. I think it's up in New York. They're working to revive that. Language is fascinating. And we talk about Indo-European languages all coming along in this talk, but then you run into the languages that don't have any relationship to it at all. And you think, how did this come about? How did we figure that we can make sounds and convey images and ideas? But boy, does it work.
It does.
So what have you read that has inspired you?
Well, I have gone all over the place. And a book that I reread, because I ran out of books that people have given me during my two-week hermitage from the ice, is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Ah.
That is a book that has been ruined.
By the movies.
Not by Mary Shelley, but by the movies.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And if you go back and read the book, it is really, in fact, a serious, it is a horror story, right? But Mary Shelley's parents were social activists, and they even wanted to start a utopia. She picked up on that. And what Frankenstein really is, if you read it carefully, is an exploration of human goodness. You know, the creature in Frankenstein, the creature had no name. That Frankenstein was the doctor. Everybody thinks Frankenstein is the monster. But the creature is born good. He wants to love people. He wants to relate to people. And it's only the treatment that he gets that eventually turns him to evil.
Yeah, she had. They're very interesting conversations with the creature.
It is in fact a great book.
Yeah.
Among those conversations is the conversation between Frankenstein and the monster he created about what Frankenstein's responsibility is. You created me, you're responsible for me, right?
Yeah.
He wants a wife for one thing, and Frankenstein is reluctant to create another creature. So it is a book well worth reading.
And particularly in this age when we're launching into artificial intelligence and robotics, you might find that an interesting book to read. I picked up a book. I bought three books that were biographies and read them with great joy. But Stephen Walsh's biography of Debussy is a little tough. Now, he has written a two-volume work on Stravinsky that everybody is just wonderful. I think he won prizes with it. Stephen Walsh is, let me look up his title, he's Emeritus Professor of Music at Cardiff University. And I find it interesting that he has written a book on Mussorgsky and on Stravinsky. But then he decided to write a book on Debussy. There are good biographies of Debussy, who is, well, not your ideal guy. You know, he was always short of money. He could not leave women alone. He could not exactly be trusted. He was always begging money. And yet he wrote this ethereal music, this beautiful, beautiful music. But the biography goes through his life, and it touches on all these things. His many affairs. His first music teacher taught him a little bit more than music, that's for sure. And his first wife shot herself in the stomach, tried to commit suicide. He finally had a daughter, Chochu, that he doted on to the extent that he could, and she died shortly after he did. He was sick a lot of his life. But what Walsh does is take every blessed piece of music he's written and analyze it. Mm. So this is a book that is richly rewarding for a musician or someone who's into the mechanics of music. I am not. I listen to music. I love it. I remember it and so on. But the structure of it, sometimes I can get into that. But he goes into the structure of everything. And it is fascinating. It's fascinating to read, and it changed my mind on some of the stuff. I thought Pelléas and Mélisande came later in his career. It came fairly early, but he just had it in piano score, and it took several years, six or so, before there was a prospect of it being performed, and he sat down to immediately orchestrate it. Obviously, he had the sounds in his mind all the time. He did little performances to earn some money about the music of Wagner, accompanying a guy talking about Wagner and singing it. And Wagner overwhelmed all musicians everywhere in Europe. And he took some things from Wagner, but he took them his own way. And the thing about Debussy was he really was on his own path from the very beginning. We hear about his life in the Paris Conservatoire and about the teachers wanting him to conform, and they did. But they always recognized his genius, even when they were critiquing him. They knew this young man was extraordinary. So anyway, it's not a book I would recommend to a casual reader, but if you're a musician, if you are a pianist, I think you'd find this fascinating. Debussy by Stephen Walsh, A Painter in Sound. And what does it cost? $28.95. And if you look in the right place, you can get a discount, I am sure.
Well, I have a book for a specific audience, too. If you're looking for a book for a grandson or granddaughter who's anywhere from 5 to 70, Robert McFarlane, who's a nature writer, has written a book of poems, short book of poems, 126 pages, called The Lost Words, lavishly illustrated. And what these lost words are the words that the new edition of the Oxford Junior Oxford Junior Dictionary has cut out of their new edition. Language is always changing.
Oh, yeah.
Words are always dropping out and coming in. In fact, there are, in the English language, about 900 words left that are English. All the rest are imports from everywhere else, Norway, mm-hmm. Russia, France, everywhere, Latin a lot. But this edition of the Oxford Junior Dictionary really raised some hackles because the words that it cut out to make room for the new words are all words that have to do with nature. For instance, these are words that are left out of the new edition. Adder, bluebell, bramble, fern, heather, kingfisher, otter, raven, willow, wren.
Really?
All of them gone.
That's remarkable.
But they need to make place for what words? Blog, broadband, ballet point, bullet point.
Huh.
And that does happen. But what McFarlane has done, obviously what this does is take kids, if you don't know the word for wren, you're probably not going to notice the wren. You might notice a bird out there. But to take a word away from a kid is to lose some insight into what that word represents. So what McFarland has done is take all of these words that are gone. Acorn is another one.
You're kidding.
Nope. Nope.
That's ridiculous.
And composed a poem about each one. And here's the fern poem.
Okay.
It is... You know, if you don't have a grandchild, buy it for yourself. It's so good. Fern's first form is furled. Each frond fast as a fiddlehead. Reach, roll, and unfold follows. Fern flares. Now fern is fully fanned.
Very good.
And so these are plays on words. The Lost Words by Robert McFarlane. You need to buy that. Uh-huh. And a grandson or a granddaughter can be an excuse.
Well, speaking of words, there's a book by Laura Mucha, M-U-C-H-A, called Love Factually. And she gives different words that the Greeks used for different kinds of love. Storge, which I don't think is a Greek word, but they used it. That's the natural affection a parent feels for a child. Eros is romantic love. Ludus is for playful affection between children or casual lovers. Philia for loving friendship. Pragma for mature love, including patience, tolerance, and compromise. Philautia, self-love, and agape for selfless, unconditional love that expects nothing in return. And the idea is, you know, that relationships often begin in Eros, and if you're lucky, it eases into a mixture of pragma and philia, perhaps a little agape in there. And as one reviewer said, once the sex goes and the noisy eating of soup becomes noticeable, kindness and companionate affection are what will keep you together.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
I particularly like some of the quotes she has. Erich Fromm: love is an activity, not a passive affect. It is a standing in, not a falling for. In the most general way, the active character of love can be described by stating that love is primarily giving, not receiving. And François de la Rochefoucauld says, true love is like the appearance of ghosts, which everyone talks about and few have seen. And she also gives an example from Stendhal. He talks about the salt mines of Salzburg, where they throw a leafless, wintry bough into one of the abandoned workings. 2 or 3 months later, they bring it out, covered with a shining deposit of crystals. The smallest twig is studded with a galaxy of scintillating diamonds. The original branch is no longer recognizable. And he uses that as an image of love. Of course, if you leave it out, pretty much all you're left with is a stick. But this is a fascinating book, Love Factually, by Laura Mucha, M-U-C-H-A. And that's one I think you would find enjoyable. She interviewed people all over the place, from 8 to 90. She must have been a real pain, because everybody she ran into for a period of years, she asked them about love, and she carried a little recorder with her, and she recorded all that. She also looked up, what some philosophers and psychologists and so on have said, but she really pays a great deal of attention to what people say. And she points out that you talk about heartbreak, that can happen. Stress, cardiomyopathy, also known as the broken heart syndrome, is a real medical condition in which extreme emotional stress can change the shape of your left ventricle, causing chest pain, breathlessness, and, as someone said, the urge to write bad poetry. Love Factually. That's one you'll enjoy. Have another?
I have another one, and this one is for if you have a grandchild who is a little older than 5 to 10, who might be into science fiction, a young adult fiction. This is a book that Nan Carter sent me, among many that she deluges me with. It's called Binti, B-I-N-T-I, by a U.S. citizen who was born to Nigerian immigrants. So she's essentially Nigerian. Her name, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, is Nnedi Okorafor, Nnedi Okorafor. It's science fiction. And she's won Nebula and Hugo Awards, it turns out. You know, you think of science fiction as purely much a Western phenomenon. But here is a Nigerian using Nigerian folklore and folktales and folk wisdom to write a science fiction story. Essentially, the story is a young student named Binti, who is accepted to Uzma University, the best in the galaxy, where only 5% of the students are human. And on the spacecraft, on the way there, the spacecraft is taken over by enemy aliens who are intent on destroying the university and most of the universe's civilizations. And she has to talk them into peace. And using Nigerian folklore and folk wisdom in this futuristic science fiction novel, she accomplishes that. If you've got somebody that thinks they've read all the science fiction there is to read, here's one that just comes right out of left field and is astounding.
What's the name of that?
Binti, B-I-N-T-I.
Binti, okay. The author's name is going to be tough, but Binti, you can remember.
Okorafor.
Okorafor. Okay. I picked up a little book I just mentioned briefly called Aristotle's Way. I was doing a course in Comm University about Sophocles and Shakespeare run for president, and Aristotle got in the way. We spent a lot of time on Aristotle, so I picked up this book, and it's by Edith Hall. It's called How Ancient Wisdom Can Change Your Life. And she goes through different aspects of it: happiness, potential, decisions, communication, self-knowledge, intentions, love, community, leisure, mortality. I've read a lot about Aristotle lately, The Cave in the Light, about the influence of Plato and Aristotle on Western civilization, how one is ascendant and then the other. Aristotle has always been my favorite because he was a very practical guy. Plato had his mind in the sky. But Aristotle's Way, How Ancient Wisdom Can Change Your Life, actually can do you some good, and I would recommend it.
Me, my turn?
Yeah.
All right. This is a book that Don Erickson gave me called The Ground Beneath Us by Paul Bogard. He has a way of studying things that other people tend not to study, but that we probably ought to be interested in. And in this case, it's the ground that, you know, we grow our crops on, that we build our buildings on, that we put our foundations in, the earth, right? And it turned out to be an incredibly fascinating book that shows me, and it'll show any reader, how little attention we really pay to things. Start out, for example, with an apple, cut the apple in quarters and throw three quarters away because that's the sea, right? That's water.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest of life is on that one quarter. Cut that quarter in half because half the land is uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. Cut that little half of a quarter in half, and what you have left is a thin peeling, not quite a 16th of an inch thin, on which we have to grow all our crops, on which the entire universe of humans has to eat. But take 1 teaspoon of that soil anywhere, the ground beneath you, and it will contain approximately 2 million separate species of life, of which probably 200,000 has yet to be identified or discovered.
It is amazing how little we know about the world we live in.
That morphed me onto another book that says there are probably, most biologists think, about 10 to 12 million different species of creatures, of which we have identified so far by name 2 million.
Yeah. It's just overwhelming. We are not accustomed to thinking of the fact that we live in a sea of living things. The air that you breathe is loaded with life. Every breath you take, every inspiration, to go back to that word, you bring in a trillion little microbes. And when you breathe out, there goes another trillion. And we live in this ocean that we don't see. You know, it's good to think of yourself as a fish in water. We are in this ocean of air. And it is loaded with creatures we don't know. And the ground is the same way. And the sea is the same way. The earth is boiling with life. And we are having an impact on it, particularly the larger life forms.
Let me add one little thing to that. Every breath of air you take, the chances are 99.99%. that one of those molecules in that molecule of air, Socrates, also breathed.
Yeah, that's true.
Unbelievable.
I often thought it would be nice to stand on the Acropolis, just to be on the ground where these great thinkers, the people who started human beings in a systematic study of thought, just to be on that ground would be kind of thrilling. Even though it's fallen into ruin, it's kind of shabby, they're working to improve it, but still just to be there. And there's something about the air in Greece. When you go to one of those Greek theaters and stand on the stage and speak, you can be heard at the furthest extreme of the audience. And it's acoustics, but there's also something about the air. It's just, the world is a miraculous place. I tell you, what's the name of that last book?
The ground beneath us.
The ground beneath us. Okay, the ground beneath us is, as we say, boiling with life, and there's a book that can put you in touch with it. And there's another one called Never Home Alone, and that'll scare you to death.
Oh, I just read a review of that, about all the creatures that, when you take a shower, you're taking a shower with with thousands of other creatures.
And you're taking a shower with creatures that didn't exist before. It's just astounding. But we're out of time here. We've had a chance to review some books. We'll get back to this again, but we'll see what happens next week. I'm Don Wilt with Roll Tweet. See you next week for the next edition of Scribble.